This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Hugo Chavez, Venezuela, and growing anti-Americanism south of the border. I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today on the show, left-leaning anti-American governments are proliferating throughout Latin America. For decades, the leader in socialist anti-American dogma has been Cuba's Fidel Castro. But Venezuela's president, a great friend of Fidel's, Hugo Chavez, is quickly climbing the power ladder of our hemisphere, all the while angering the U.S. government. How does Chavez reflect growing anti-Americanism in Latin America? On Reporter's Notebook later on, hero Lance Armstrong is accused of taking performance-enhancing drugs. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. Apart from the war on drugs and financial crises, Latin American news rarely commands our headlines. But the lately charismatic and anti-American president of Venezuela is grabbing our attention. Hugo Chavez is an elected head of state, and yet the United States considers him a hostile despot. Today we talk about our current relations with Latin American countries in general, and with Hugo Chavez in particular. Reporter's Notebook a bit later, allegations of drug use by Tour de France champion Lance Armstrong are nothing new, but this time the finger of blame may have some credible science behind it. First, this news today. With the new constitution in Iraq stalled, with multiple factions raging war across the country, radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is calling for a countrywide moratorium on violence, at least for the moment. Al-Sadr asks all Muslims to return to their homes and says Iraq is passing through a critical and difficult period that requires unity. Well, joining us now from Baghdad is the Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek magazine, Scott Johnson. Mr. Johnson, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Let's talk first of all about this plea from Mr. Al-Sadr. Has it had any effect in the last 24 hours, or are people laying down arms or talking about it?
Well, I think the plea for peace did have an effect after a very violent day down in the southern cities of Karbala, Najaf, Basra, other regions throughout the south, where forces loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr clashed with gunmen from larger political organizations, Skiri. It started when some people from Sadr's group tried to reopen their offices in the holy city of Najaf. And that aroused the ire of the local population, who began to pelt them with stones, and that very quickly escalated into fighting with machine guns and RPGs and so on. So that went on for a while, and then both sides agreed to come to the table to set some terms for peace, and that has prevailed at least over the last several hours, and we'll see what happens in the next few days.
All right, this group you're speaking of, Skiri, stands for Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and their leader, Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, is a foe of Mr. al-Sadr's, and evidently they were behind the attack on Mr. al-Sadr's office, four of his men killed a couple of days ago. Was it surprising that directly after that attack, Mr. al-Sadr comes out and asks for the laying down of arms?
Well, as you say, they have been foes traditionally, dating back for some time, and their forces have had tensions and conflict in the past. Whether or not it's a coincidence, it's hard to say at this point. I mean, I think that what's happening is that the conflict is essentially a local one, having to do with questions of who is going to retain local political power, who is going to get the next seat on the provincial assembly or the provincial council, and so on. I think that the consensus on both sides was that at this point in Iraq's very tumultuous constitutional process, it was in both of their interests to prevent further divisions from arising in the Shia bloc, which is dominant in the South. So I think that it was a calculated political move by both sides to retain some degree of unity in a situation that is increasingly violent and complex.
You know, both the sides that we're talking about right now, Skiri and al-Sadr's side, seem to blame the Americans for all the sectarian violence going on, that there are plots by the Americans. So al-Sadr had a quote yesterday, said he's pleased for the people, all of people of Iraq, not to fall for American plots that aim to divide us. What does he mean by that?
Well, this, again, is something that has a history. Both of those groups, but particularly Mr. Sadr's group, have blamed the Americans in the past for all sorts of things and have been behind accusations that the Americans are out to sow divisions among the Shia, to incite sectarian violence, deliberately killing people to stir up the situation. So the fact that they did that again this time around isn't surprising. The Skiri, less so, of course. They're more savvy politically, and they know how to operate with more subtlety, I guess you could say, in the political environment. But I think that the fact that the Americans were brought in as the troublemakers in the wake of the attacks is not surprising. It's clearly meant to please the constituents of those groups.
Okay, thank you for that. We've only got a minute left, Mr. Johnson. Let's talk about the Constitution. The 72-hour extension from Monday has come and gone. What happens now?
Well, right now, we're not actually sure. There's a great deal of confusion. I think it's fair to say that the process is sort of coming apart at the seams. They were meant to come to an agreement tonight. They have since decided to delay that, possibly until next week, possibly indefinitely. They may simply decide to nix the vote in the National Assembly altogether and put it to the people in a referendum on October 15th. That, of course, has aroused tremendous anger and resentment from the Sunni, who say that the entire process is illegitimate, a sham. One government spokesman said today that the process is at the end of the road. And
yes, well, it is complex, to say the least. I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson, I have to interrupt, but we thank you for your time. Scott Johnson from Newsweek magazine. I'll be back in a moment with more of To the Point from PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Earlier this week, former presidential candidate Pat Robertson outraged many when he suggested the United States assassinate Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Both the State and Defense Departments immediately distanced themselves from Robertson and emphatically stated that the U.S. does not engage in assassinations of elected officials. That's not to say that the Bush administration wouldn't like to see Hugo Chavez and his policies go away. And with the anti-American Mr. Chavez, a popular figure in his own country, an admirer of Fidel Castro, and a powerful influence throughout Latin America, it's a good time to examine the relationship between the U.S. and our Latin neighbors. And joining us first today to help us do so is Tim Padgett, who is the Miami and Latin America Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. Mr. Padgett, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Chavez with his own people. I just said popular. I've read huge numbers, 70-75% sort of approval rates. On the other hand, it is a democracy, and there's a lot of anti-Chavez propaganda or reporting on the Venezuelan airwaves every day. Where do the people stand behind this man?
Chavez is, first of all, is a very polarizing figure. He always has been, and in many ways, he likes it that way, fortunately or unfortunately. His approval ratings have been shooting up, particularly among Venezuela's poor, because he's been able to use this enormous oil windfall that he's been gathering from the rise in the price of oil to execute a lot of multi-billion-dollar social projects around Venezuela, particularly in places like the barrios in Caracas, that have really helped you know, elevate his approval ratings again with a vast majority of Venezuelans. His approval ratings now are, as you said, you know, back up to around 60-70%, whereas maybe a year or two ago they had been really starting to slump. So but at the same time, you know, as we pointed out, he's a very polarizing figure, and there's still a very significant portion of the country that is very worried that, despite the fact that he was democratically elected, he has a very authoritarian bent and could be leaning in directions, particularly when it comes to things like censoring the media, controlling the courts, and you know, his meddling in other democratic institutions like that. There's a fear inside Venezuela that he may be going more and more the route of Fidel Castro as his presidency evolves.
All right. Now let me ask you about the fear on the American side. You know, what is it that angers the Bush administration about Chavez and Venezuela? Because you pointed out a couple things, but on the other hand, he is elected in a free election. There is a free press there. And as I mentioned before, lots of anti-Chavez reporting, you know, every day in the papers and on the radios,
right.
I understand as much as anywhere in the world. So what is the beef? And we're still getting plenty of oil from the country. What is the beef we have?
This is where Chavez is much savvier than his mentor, Fidel Castro. Castro may be popular with Latin Americans because, in many ways, because he has always stood up to the United States. But if you ask the average Latin American, he'll tell you that he doesn't like the fact that that Castro is a dictator who throws people in jail for dissenting.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Chavez has been savvier. He's been very careful to preserve this at least veneer of democratic legitimacy. He's been democratically elected twice. He won a national recall referendum last year that was approved by international observers. And so it's harder for the Bush administration to come at him the way that the way they can at Castro. And I think that frustrates them quite a bit because they see Chavez, in Venezuela, you know, taking a much more left-wing socialist bent in terms of economic policies. But they also see him arising as sort of the standard bearer now for a resurgence of leftism across Latin America, which is due to many factors, one of them being the fact that many in Latin America simply feel that U.S.-backed capitalist reforms in the region haven't worked to the benefit of most people. In fact, many feel that it's simply widened an already epic gap between rich and poor.
Now there's something I'm having trouble with, because just before we were talking about all these new social programs and the poor have been rising up and the popularity has been, you know, creeping up on Chavez's part. On the other hand, you're saying that the U.S. intervened or implemented, you know, capitalist programs have caused a rift and a widening gap between the rich and the poor. So how can those both exist simultaneously?
Well, no, I'm not saying that they exist simultaneously. I'm saying that Chavez is really a symptom of Latin America's growing frustration with the failure of these capitalist reforms over the past decade to provide the kind of fruits to Latin America's poor that many had hoped. And since Chavez was elected in 1998, we've seen leftist politicians like him either take power or are leading presidential voting polls in 8 Latin American countries right now, including the 2 biggest, Mexico and Brazil.
You know, that's the place we need to go next. We're definitely going to spend a lot of time still on Mr. Chavez today, very important figure in our hemisphere these days. But, you know, let's widen out and how much influence Mr. Chavez is now having on the rest of South and Latin America.
Well, that's the thing that worries the Bush administration to a great extent. I don't think anyone in Washington really sees Chavez as a direct threat to the United States unless they're thinking about oil. But even in that sense, Chavez cannot cut oil exports off to the United States. It would be economic suicide for him. But what they do see Chavez and his influence doing in Latin America is seriously beginning to affect U.S. interest in areas like trade. George Bush, when he took office, was very hopeful that a hemispheric free trade pact would have been passed by now in Latin America. But Chavez and other leftist leaders in Latin America have done their best to thwart that. In areas like drugs, look at Bolivia, for example. The United States a few years ago, when Bush took office, was pointing to Bolivia as a showcase of cooperation in terms of doing things like eradicating coca leaves and other interdiction programs. Politicians like Evo Morales, leftist politicians like Evo Morales in Bolivia, have scuttled that. And Evo Morales told me in an interview a couple of years ago that Chavez is his example.
Yes, they look, don't they, in Bolivia as their natural oil fields, their natural gas fields,
exactly.
as an exact analogy of the way they'd like to proceed and implement their programs, just as Chavez has done in Venezuela.
Evo Morales leads a movement to nationalize Bolivia's energy resources, and that has a lot. It owes a lot to the influence of Chavez.
Mr. Padgett, what will be the result of these declining relations between Chavez and the U.S. administration? I mean, you said before oil won't change much because we both need each other. We're in a very, you know, we're in the perfect geographical place for them to deliver oil to us and take that profit. But I understand that Mr. Chavez has meetings all the time with Chinese and Indian officials. Is he looking to lessen the oil trade with us and increase it overseas?
Oh, definitely. I mean, if Chavez had his choice, if he had a place where he could sell, he has the largest oil reserves in the hemisphere. If there were a market that he could turn to tomorrow where he could divert that oil from the United States and sell it to another market, he would do it in a heartbeat. I'm just speculating, but I feel that's his mindset at this point. But you're right in the fact his stated desire is to sell less oil to the United States. He feels that Venezuela is simply too dependent on that huge market to the north. He wants to try to diversify his exports, and so he has been inking delivery deals with oil-thirsty giants like China, India, particularly China, because he sees China as an ideological ally, and he knows that if he can sell more oil to the to China, then it would really stick in the craw of the United States. And frankly, that a lot of what Chavez does policy-wise always has that in mind. What can I do, to really irritate the United States?
But we can see the ideology of that plan. But I mentioned just geography before, and oil is expensive. We're talking
exactly.
about pipelines, and we're just a few hundred miles away to Florida, and there's tens of thousands of miles to China. So this is not going to happen quickly.
But he's demonstrated that he's willing to try as hard as he can. They have a project going on now where they would like to build a pipeline from Venezuela across Colombia to the Colombia's Pacific coast so that they can facilitate the transshipment of oil to China. I'm certain that he will do what he can to sell as much oil to new markets like China and India in the future. And that does have politicians in Washington, particularly people like Richard Lugar, the senator from Indiana, who's been watching this carefully, that does have them worried. Because despite the fact that Venezuela does need to sell its oil to us, we still do get 15% of our petroleum from them. That represents they are the fourth largest supplier to the United States. And if that were to significantly diminish during this decade, that could really exacerbate the problems that we're already seeing with gas prices and oil prices in this country.
Oh, yes, there's no doubt about that. Well, thank you for that, Mr. Padgett. We'll come back to you. I want to welcome Moises Naim to the program now, the former Venezuelan Minister of Industry and Trade in the early 1990s. Mr. Naim coming out with a new book in October, Illicit, How Smugglers, Traffickers, and Copycats Are Hijacking the Global Economy. Mr. Naim, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's stick on this oil subject for a moment. Do you see the pressure from Mr. Chavez within his country to have less oil trade with the U.S. and considerably more with China?
Yes, I agree with Tim Padgett's analysis. The only point I would add is that Venezuelans are as addicted to selling their oil as Americans are to their SUVs. Venezuela cannot afford any decline in their oil exports. Venezuela is terribly dependent. Almost all of the foreign exchange that comes into the country comes from oil. Almost completely all of the government revenues that are spent by Mr. Chavez come from oil. So, it's easy to say that, I would rather see my oil go to China rather than the U.S., but remember that the oil market today is a global market, is an integrated market, and, you don't sell it to the U.S., you sell it to somebody else, but you are selling it to a global pool of oil that determines price.
And what about the future in Venezuela, the economic future? I mean, we just spoke about these, you know, wonderful social programs that Chavez has brought in over the last couple of years, all on oil money, helped the poor of the country, helped his popularity, et cetera. But when you base your entire economy on one natural resource, you know, what is the future down the road? What is the stability for Venezuela 10, 15 years from now?
Well, both Venezuela and other oil-rich countries have seen this picture before, in which high oil prices drive all sorts of initiatives, then the price of oil goes down, and it all the boom ends in tears. In fact, it's very difficult to find an oil-based economy that is successful, except for perhaps for Norway. And this has happened before in Venezuela. All the presidents have done what Chavez has done in terms of spending oil money to essentially subsidize the country's different activities. Mr. Chavez's handouts are very, very frail in terms of institutionalizations. They are heavily dependent on a lot of money. Without a lot of money, that system cannot go on. And once the price of oil goes down or the oil revenues go down, Ms. Chavez will have to resort to other tools to retain power, and his popularity would certainly go down.
Okay, stay with us, will you? Mr. Naim, I want to go to Mark Cooper now, contributing editor to The Nation magazine, a columnist for L.A. Weekly, who actually served as a translator for Chilean President Salvador Allende back in the early 70s before he was deposed in a U.S.-backed military coup. Mr. Cooper, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We have to take a break, but I wanted to get you in before the break to talk basically about the bigger picture of, you know, President Bush pushing democracy, of course, all over the world, and recently, you know, trying to push democracy in South America, Latin America. But this sort of push doesn't go over big at the moment with a lot of these countries, especially Chavez, does it?
Well, you know, the it's not just the Bush administration, but the United States record in Latin America is not a very good one when pushing for democracy. And many of the major countries in Latin America, not Venezuela in this particular case, but certainly Argentina, Chile, Brazil, to a degree, Uruguay, these are countries that are still convalescing. They're still recovering from a period of military dictatorship that was supported by the United States, a period in which state-sponsored terrorism, by the way, was a trademark of some of these regimes. So the Bush rhetoric about bringing democracy is viewed a completely different way in Latin America than it is, say, in Ohio.
Yeah, and it would seem, and many reporters and columnists, yourself included, over the past week or so, since Mr. Robertson's remarks about taking out Mr. Chavez have said that, you know, this has just been fuel for the fire and been very positive, actually, for Chavez and his message.
Well, Pat Robertson, of course, is a buffoon and should not be taken seriously. It's kind of amazing to the degree that he is taken seriously by different sectors of the American media.
Hmm.
That said, the policy that the United States has toward Venezuela at the moment seems to be headed in the same way that U.S. policy was headed toward Cuba. So the question is, what outcome does the United States want? And that is not a defense of Hugo Chavez. He is both democratically elected, and as your other guests have mentioned, he's also quite problematic. There are concerns that people with democratic principles should have when it comes to Hugo Chavez.
All right, Mr. Cooper, you're breaking up a little, and we'll take a short break, get your connection a little bit better when we get back, and continue with both the democratic and economic realities in South America. We'll be right back in a minute with more of To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're discussing U.S.-Latin American relations, and specifically our non-relationship with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Tim Padgett's with us, Miami and Latin America Bureau Chief for Time magazine. Mr. Padgett, I'm reading in a fairly recent article of yours a quote by Chavez saying that Latin America is done kneeling to take orders from the White House. Is this a sentiment that's spreading pretty strongly throughout Latin America, or is Chavez and of course, Fidel Castro a little bit stronger than the rest?
I think Chavez represents the louder end of the spectrum of that sentiment. But the thing that you do have to understand about the general sentiment in Latin America toward the United States these days is that I would say that America's stock and credibility right now is at an unusually low ebb in Latin America, which is one of the reasons why a lot of people thought that the White House should have been a little harsher in its condemnation of Pat Robertson's appalling remarks the other day.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons is, as I mentioned before, the fact that these capitalist and free market reforms that so many people in Latin America identify with the United States. Well, I mean, they were called the Washington Consensus, these reforms. They have just not produced the benefits, and in some cases, in many cases, have exacerbated the economic problems that many people in Latin America have had. So that's one problem that Latin Americans have. But the thing that I think has really set that off is the fact that rather than trying to engage Latin America to improve that, people feel that the Bush administration has just been utterly disengaged from Latin America after 9/11. That the Bush administration has just sort of turned its back on the region, especially when most of the governments in the region declined to join up with President Bush in the war in Iraq, particularly Mexico. I mean, a lot of Latin Americans are just very resentful of the fact that George Bush, who had declared himself Mexican President Vicente Fox's best amigo when he was elected, essentially just turned a very cold shoulder to Fox when Fox told him, look, I cannot, back you in the UN on this war in Iraq. So there's a feeling that the Bush administration in the United States have just not only neglected, but have just turned their back on Latin America. And that has created the vacuum, really, in which more radical anti-U.S. Figures like Chavez can emerge.
Yeah, so you're actually laying out the fact that intervention is the past history of us and Latin America.
That's
and at
the
moment it's ignoring them.
Yeah, that's the irony. It's not in intervention was a problem before. Now it seems to be it's a disengagement that's causing the resentment.
Okay, let's turn to Mark Weisbrot, who's an economist and co-director for the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which is a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C. Mr. Weisbrot, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Diane. It's always a pleasure to be on this show.
Yeah, well, this is a big, overwhelming question, but I'm just going to throw it out there. Why? Well, what is it that we need in our relations with Latin America? We've already spoken about the oil in Venezuela, and regardless of how much ire there is between our administration and Mr. Chavez at the moment, the oil deal is not going away anytime soon. So what is it that we need to keep relations going for specifically throughout Latin America?
Well, first, let's start with Venezuela. I've spoken with the Venezuelan government at all levels, including President Chavez, and I think, they would like to have good relations with the United States, but, think about what we would feel like here if, say, France supported a military coup against our elected government and then didn't apologize for it at all or anything, and then went on to then try to have the president impeached and funded opposition groups and things like that.
So you're making the analogy to Chavez's attempted coup in 2002. Go through that for us a little bit.
Well, the United States was really involved in that in a factual sense. If you look at the CIA documents that were released, a few months ago, actually, they said very clearly and these were documents from the CIA, said that the Bush administration had been briefed that there was going to be a coup, so they had advanced knowledge of it. And it's not whether they warned him or not. I mean, they'll say they warned him, and he says they didn't. But the important point that was missed a lot, except in the New York Times, which reported it very well, they actually, when the coup happened, the State Department and the White House both publicly pretended that it wasn't a coup, and gave the official line of the people who carried out the coup and tried to convince the world that it wasn't a coup, that it was actually just an uprising in response to repression by the government. So in other words, they were involved in the coup, and they tried to convince other governments, according to the Mexican foreign minister and according to the Spanish government, they tried to convince other governments to also support the coup. So they were clearly involved, and they also gave money to organizations and people that were involved in the coup. So this is a very serious thing. Any government in the world would be very upset. It would take them a while. And it's not just Chavez, but the people there also feel like this as well. Sometimes he's actually a moderating influence in terms of what other people in the government and outside the government think about relations with the United States. So that's the first thing I think people have to understand, is that the United States has to respect democracy and democratic elections. And I think one of the reasons the Bush administration has become so isolated since last August, when the government, you know, Chavez won a recall election by a large majority, is that everyone else in Latin America, you know, just accepted that and said, well, it's over now. You know, he's won again. It's the third time. And the United States, the Bush administration, continued to go around to various governments and embassies and say, you know, you have to help us isolate Chavez. Well, in the process, they just succeeded in isolating themselves.
Yes, the reverse has happened. Moises Naim, come back with us, will you? Mr. Naim, the former Venezuelan Minister of Industry and Trade in the early 1990s. A personal question to you, but I think it will be indicative of what's happening in that country, your former country, Venezuela. Why did you leave? I mean, this is a country that was the most content, the most successful of the Latin American countries for decades and decades, and things have changed radically. Why did you leave?
Yeah, before answering the personal question, let me set the record straight. It would be very, very difficult to paint Chavez as a helpless victim of the United States and the Bush administration, and just explain him away as the result of all the incompetence and the blunders and the abuses of the American governments, both the Clinton administration in the 90s and the Bush
No, but there are some valid points in there.
Well, but let me read you some of the statements made by Chavez or his people just before. In days after 9/11, the vice president of the country said that the terrorism of the oppressed is a perverse and lamentable byproduct of a WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant dominance that has become unbearable for the most radical and violent of the subjugated peoples. And she then went on to blame the WASPs for the 9/11 attacks. President Chavez has stated that the U.S. is the most savage, cruel, and murderous empire that has existed in the history of the world. He has also said that the cause of the world's greatest concern is the government of the United States, a government that abuses human rights, a government that invades, that kills, that bombs without mercy. He has also said that Condoleezza Rice is an ignorant, that she, what happens to her, she, you know, she doesn't have a man, and that he offered some of his cabinet members to for her. He has.
Well, he goes so far as to say that Condoleezza Rice has a crush
television.
On him.
He said yeah. that on television. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we're talking about is not all I'm saying is trying to compensate a view that essentially says that Chavez is a democratic elected president, which he is, of course. He's just the helpless victim of this empire that goes around pushing. And of course, Latin America has had a horrible history of intervention on the part of the United States, but it also has had some interventions from others. The proxy wars in Central America were not just the sole initiative of the United States. Cuba has been very, very active in a variety of ways. So all I'm saying is to try to bring some balance to the descriptions that we are hearing about what's going on.
Okay, fair enough. Now go back to my personal question. Why'd you leave?
I was invited to become a member of the board of directors of the World Bank.
Okay, so it's just simple job. But you know what I'm trying to get at. What do you feel about what's happening to your country under Chavez?
I continue to have very strong ties with my country. I go there very, very often. My family is still there. I hope to go back there as soon as possible. And I lament the direction in which my country is going.
Mark Cooper, will you come back with us now, contributing editor to The Nation magazine, columnist for LA Weekly? Mr. Cooper, would it be naive, or could we go so far as to make a bit of a Cold War analogy here, a growing socialism from Cuba to Venezuela to Bolivia to perhaps Brazil, and the United States fearing more the ideology that's developing than anything concrete?
No, not unless the United States government decides it wants to view the situation that way. You're not looking at an upsurge of socialist revolution in Latin America. You're looking at what Tim Padgett said. You're looking at a natural reaction to a set of free market policies over the last 10 or 15 years that have failed. So you're looking at more populist, what we call in the United States, more liberal governments, want to emphasize more on social spending, want different trade relations with the United States than those that currently exist. And the more extreme example of this is Venezuela. But if the United States insists on playing Goliath to Hugo Chavez, then Hugo Chavez positioning of himself as David against Goliath is going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I would agree with Mr. Naim to a great degree that Mr. Chavez is no angel. He's a democratically elected but flawed president. But right now, the United States is playing to all of his strengths and none of his weaknesses.
Okay. And I guess so to take it a notch down from where I was trying to go with the Cold War analogy, but still, is there something threatening about the possibility of South American countries banding and gathering together, not for social uprising, but just economic, social, military alliances right here in our hemisphere?
There's nothing threatening about that, except in the minds of very extreme ideologues on our side of the fence, that the Latin America should develop into a more robust economic and regional trading bloc can only be a benefit to them and to us. But that has not, you know, up to now, we've had a very, very unequal power relationship in the hemisphere. And if the United States continues to demand that relationship remain as unequal as it has been, then you will find more antagonism. There's no threats here. All there are the natural desires of a region plagued by poverty and underdevelopment to come into the modern world on some sort of equal footing with the most powerful entity in its backyard.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Moises Naim, can you weigh in on that same question? When I say threatening, I don't mean really in a violent sort of way. I'm just talking about a power structure sort of way. South American countries banding together?
I agree with Mr. Cooper. There is a saying that, unfortunately, it's very sad, that says that Latin America is not competitive even as a threat. Latin America does not have weapons of mass destruction, doesn't have Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. Latin America threatens the United States with its social weakness. And is exporting millions of Latins to the streets of this country, and it's very important that Latin America gets it on its footing and its economic footing right, and stabilizes economically and provides prosperity and jobs and a better living for everyone. That is not going to happen using failed policies that we know have failed everywhere before.
You know, I wanted Tim Padgett to come back in for a minute, Miami Latin America bureau chief for Time Magazine. Mr. Padgett, you've written a lot about the foreign investment level and the foreign investments being sort of alienated and denied with these leftist governments, starting with Chavez's. Is this good for the people, or the leftist governments in an economic sense, good for the people of the countries?
Well, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you look at places like Venezuela and Bolivia, and their feeling is we're taking back, as Chavez often says, our natural resource sovereignty. They just feel that in this era of globalization, the multinationals and U.S. firms, et cetera, have just been able to sort of run roughshod over the economic basis of these countries, be it oil in Venezuela or natural gas in Bolivia. And so there's a feeling that the sovereignty over these resources is being channeled back to communities and the grassroots. That's not a bad thing. But on the other hand, as we were discussing before, the problem with economies that are based on natural resources is that they become too dependent on those resources, and there's no economic diversification. And my fear, personally, My wife's Venezuelan. I have family in Venezuela, and I worry about this all the time in the sense that I worry that Chavez is making the same mistake that his corrupt predecessors did in many ways, which is not depend too much on that gusher of oil to provide economic paradise and not channel enough of that money into diversifying your economy to make it stronger. The same thing's happening in Bolivia as well.
And Mexico.
And Mexico. And what it does is just produces that chronic cycle of economic impoverishment. You go through boom and bust cycles all the time, and as Moises Naim said before, eventually oil prices will go down, and will Chavez have made Venezuela a stronger and more diversified economy in the meantime to deal with that? Right now, I don't see him doing it.
Okay, Mark Weisbrot is with us still, economist and co-director for the Center for Economic and Policy Research in D.C. Mr. Weisbrot, big think question. What should the U.S. policy toward these countries, especially Venezuela, be in order to benefit both our interests in the near future?
Well, I think the main thing is to let them do what they want to do. Each country is going to find its own path to development. And let me clarify the economic situation a bit that everyone has touched upon.
Okay.
It's much worse than most Americans think. It isn't just the last few years or anything like that. You've had now a 25-year period in Latin America where there's been very, very little growth of income per person, of GDP, however you want to describe it, the most basic measure that economists use.
Even with all these, wonderful social programs in Venezuela.
Well, I'm talking about the last 25 years, not the last two.
Okay, okay.
I mean, Venezuela growing very rapidly right now and grew at 17% last year. That's just a couple of years. But the point is that over an entire 25-year period, income per person has grown by only 14%. Now, that is worse than any period in Latin American history that we know of. Even if you include the Great Depression, you can't find anything that bad. It's actually not very common in the history of capitalism to have a period that bad, just on the basis, and this isn't even saying anything about distribution, which has also gotten worse. So, just to compare it, the previous 20 years, a shorter period, from 1960 to 79, income per person in Latin America grew by 80%. And Brazil, for example, would have European living standards today if it had simply continued to grow at its prior rate. Mexico would also be close.
But what's your point for the immediate future?
Well, these countries are going to have to change their economic policies, as Tim Padgett very astutely pointed out. There's been six elections and probably be a couple more where the electorate very clearly rejected these economic policies, and the governments didn't necessarily do everything that they wanted. But what you're seeing is in some places, in Argentina, for example, which is very successful, defied all the experts by defaulting on its debt, taking a hard line against its creditors, saying no to the IMF, and has grown very robustly now for 2.5 years, 9% for 2003 and 2004, and growing fastest growing in Latin America still. So, some of the criticisms of Venezuela are correct in terms of economic policy and dependence on oil, but nonetheless, they're at least made a start. They're investing very heavily in education and healthcare, and they're experimenting with other ways to lessen their dependence on oil. And I should say also that the private sector there is a greater percentage of the economy now than it was when Chavez took office. So
all right,
despite all the problems, even that has to be regarded as a partial success.
Thanks, Mr. Weisbrot. I'm sorry, but I want to get Moises Naim in just one more time. You all have so much to say, and I apologize for cutting anybody off. Mr. Naim, let's give you the last word today. If democracy is not, a big agenda among a lot of the countries we're talking about, their quote is at the recent Organization of American States, please take your fight elsewhere. Not interested in promoting and fighting for democracy, Venezuela anyway. If free trade, foreign investment is not a big issue at the moment, too. What should our relationship be with
Latin
America? Well,
the lack of interest in democracy is only among those that are in power and don't want to have democracy. Ask a significant majority of Venezuelans, and Venezuela comes up at the top of the countries in terms of their desire for democracy, and not only in terms of elections. By now, everybody understands that equating democracy and elections is probably a mistake. You can't have one election and then the president that wins with a great majority then starts to dismantle the checks and balances.
Sure.
And I would be very
wrap
careful.
Wrap it up for us, will you? Wrap it up. I'm sorry.
I would be very careful to dismiss democracy as a goal. What we have learned is that you cannot give democracy to people from out of the barrel of a gun. You have to let democracy grow from inside, but at the same time, it needs a lot of protection against those that talk like Democrats but act as tyrants.
Okay, well said, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much for allowing me to push you to the end there. That was Moises Naim, Mark Cooper, Tim Padgett, Mark Weisbrot. I thank all four of you gentlemen today. Very knowledgeable on your subject. On Reporter's Notebook in just a minute, cyclist Lance Armstrong, a worldwide hero just a few weeks ago, today on the hot seat under new allegations of drug use. We'll be right back with more of To the Point from PRI.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Seven-time Tour de France winner and hero cancer survivor Lance Armstrong has been accused of taking performance-enhancing drugs many times throughout his career. But Armstrong has been tested repeatedly and never tested positive. The allegations have often been chalked up to jealousy and just plain disbelief that anybody could be that superior. Well, now, the French newspaper L'Equipe has published results from a 1999 batch of Armstrong's samples that say unequivocally that he had the illegal substance EPO in his system during that, his first victory at the Tour de France. Here to talk about this with us is Dr. John Hoberman, who's a doping historian. His most recent book, and he's written many on the subject, is called Testosterone Dreams, Rejuvenation, Aphrodisia, Doping. Dr. Hoberman, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
You know, let's educate our listeners, just in case they don't know, about A and B samples, why there are two sets of samples so that, you know, we can be quite sure if someone has or hasn't taken something.
A urine sample that is taken from an athlete is divided into two samples in order that there be a backup procedure available. The A sample is tested. If a positive results, then the athlete and his or her representatives are invited to the opening of the B sample and the laboratory analysis of the B sample so that they can hopefully be satisfied that it's a fair procedure.
Okay. So you've got a backup and a corroboration. So what's happened here is that back in 1999, that first year that Lance Armstrong came out of the hospital bed with multiple cancers, wins this in a heroic fashion, the greatest endurance event on Earth, his A samples are tested, and evidently he was clear sailing through that. But the caveat here is that back in 1999, at least at the Tour de France, there was no test for EPO. So that A sample was never tested for EPO. Am I right?
Yeah.
And now it's 7 years later, and the B samples were frozen and supposedly kept uncontaminated. They've been tested, and six of his B samples from that same race, which sounds to me like a mathematically large number, have tested positive for EPO. So where do they stand in terms of determining what really happened and what didn't?
One of the consequences of the L'Equipe revelation or claims is that a scientific debate has broken out over the status of the B sample that had been retained in a frozen condition over a period of 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
For example, two German experts have come out on different sides of this issue. The head of the German anti-doping agency, Roland Augustin, is not satisfied that there has been sufficient scientific evidence to demonstrate the viability of that old sample. On the other hand, an even more experienced German expert, Wilhelm Schenzer, the head of the famous IOC-accredited doping lab in Cologne, Germany, says, quote, urine samples can be kept in storage temperatures of between minus 20 and minus 40 degrees for years. The results are scientifically valid for me. If Mr. Cerise says they're positive, then you can be assured that it's right, unquote, Dr. Wilhelm Schenzer, the doping expert from Cologne. Here you have a colleague-to-colleague expression of support. And even there, I mean, for somebody who's been in the business of studying this for a long time, I would want to know something. It's not that I'm automatically suspicious, but in order to be as objective and accurate as possible, I frankly would want to have some information about the professional relationship between Dr. Sarriz, the French expert at this laboratory who analyzed the samples or supervised the analysis, and the two Germans. One of the things you have to keep in mind when you are dealing with the complex phenomenon we call doping is that there is a human factor as well as a biochemical factor
mm-hmm.
that is studied in the lab. You have to study the people who are operating the labs, and you have to study the people who are going to be handling the information that comes out of the labs.
All right. Let me just also let people at home know, because I think that the mass public, even who don't follow sports, know that when we use the term testosterone and steroids, we're talking about building muscle and explosive speed and strength. When we talk about EPO, it's actually natural to the body, but you can take it unnaturally, called erythropoietin. And what that does is it increases red blood corpuscles that carry oxygen to the muscle. So an endurance athlete would be, helped along by that. But here we go, Dr. Hoberman. I'm thinking, okay, as regardless of what the current findings of the B samples are, from the German, from the French scientists, et cetera, if the A samples were never tested, and that is the letter of the law in Olympic sports, in the Tour de France, in most sports today, then regardless of what our suspicions might be, we really don't have the corroboration that it requires to call an athlete dirty and rescind his titles, do we?
That is correct, that without both the A and B positives, you do not have the basis for a formal sanction by an administrative body. Now, and everybody involved in the current controversy seems to sign on to that point. However, as we all know, this is not simply a matter of administrating the official rules of a sports federation. This is an enormous case outside the halls of administration. This is a global figure, a person who has been credited with almost superhuman ability. He has, and this is a point that the American audience really has been cheated of by the coverage we've seen.
I'm sorry, Dr. Hoberman. I apologize. You're always so interesting, but we've run out of time. I thank you for all your words today. And just to let people know that Lance Armstrong has responded by saying the allegations are preposterous. Today's program was produced by Dr. Jonah King. I'm saying goodbye to Dr. John Hoberman first. And you can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.